This is the State Senate Affairs Committee. Today's date is February 3rd, 2011. The time is 9 o'clock in the morning. We have with us today Senator Geisel, Senator Meyer, and myself, Wilikowski, Pasfan, and Kukesh are excused. Today we have two bills before us. The first is Senate Bill 7, an act relating to a felon's right to vote or serve as a juror. The second is Senate Bill 30, an act providing for the release of property in the custody of a law enforcement agency. We'll begin with Senate Bill 7, sponsored by Senator Davis. Welcome to the committee, Senator Davis.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of this committee, and thank you for hearing this bill in a timely manner. This is not the first time this bill has been introduced, so some of you might have heard it before. I feel that it's an important issue, and I'm glad to get it out on the forefront early so that we might have some time to really get testimony and move the bill forward. I have with me my staffer, Tom Obermeyer. He's going to give the overview of the bill. And we'll hear to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Senator Davis. Mr. Obermeyer, welcome to the committee. If you could put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Tom Obermeyer, staff to Senator Davis. The bill before you is Senate Bill 7, an act relating to the civil rights of felons. The Alaska Constitution, Article 5, Section 2, bars a person to vote who has been convicted of a felony of moral turpitude unless his civil rights have been restored. The right to vote remains suspended from the date of conviction through the date of release from all conviction-related disabilities, including probation and parole. According to the Alaska Department of Corrections offender profile, in 2009, more than 10,000 Alaskans were ineligible to vote pursuant to this provision. This bill allows felons to register to vote immediately upon release from incarceration and start assuming responsibility for their reintegration into their communities. Harsher sentencing laws over the past 30 years have allowed the prison population to balloon while reducing the rehabilitative model to almost non-existence. Article 1, Section 12 of the Alaska Constitution requires, criminal administration shall be based upon the principle of reformation. In Alaska, the prison population increased from 800 prisoners in 1984 to over 5,000 in 2008, an increase of over 600%. Of those incarcerated in Alaska, 48% were Caucasian, 52% were minorities. Although Alaska Natives represent only 16% of the population, they comprised 35% of total offenders in the institutions in 2009. Likewise, African Americans represent 4% of the population but comprise 10% of the incarcerated. Nationally, minority felons are disproportionately disenfranchised under current law, and the harm of this continued disenfranchisement after release is exacerbated by stigma and other forms of discrimination as they try to reenter society. An estimated 5.3 million American citizens cannot vote because of a criminal conviction. Of these, 4 million are out of prison and living and working in communities. Restoring a person's right to vote is a critical element to the successful reentry into society after incarceration and is consistent with our democracy's modern ideal of universal suffrage. The Democracy Restoration Act of 2009 was introduced in both houses of Congress to restore the right to vote to citizens once released from prison. It would affect more than 41,000 people on parole. Felons across the country often cannot sit on juries, serve as teachers, firefighters, or even barbers or plumbers, receive food stamps, or live in public housing. These ex-offenders have a vested interest in what happens in society, and if they are to participate, they should have a right to vote. The National Conference of State Legislatures in 2009 found that disenfranchisement still varies tremendously from state to state. In Maine and Vermont, felons do not lose their right to vote. Even felons who are serving in prison sentence can vote. In 13 states in the District of Columbia, felons are ineligible to vote only while serving a prison sentence. Ex-offenders and those on probation and parole can vote. In 25 states, prisoners and people under community supervision, probation, and or parole are ineligible to vote, but ex-offenders are eligible. In 8 states, all felons in prison and those in community supervision, as well as certain ex-offenders, are ineligible to vote. In Kentucky and Virginia, all felons and ex-offenders are permanently ineligible to vote, absent a pardon. Those are the only two states. NCSL reported that between 1996 and 2008, 28 states passed new laws on felon voting rights, which included 7 states repealed lifetime disenfranchisement laws for at least some ex-offenders. 2 states gave probationers the right to vote. 7 states improved data sharing procedures among state agencies. 9 states passed requirements that ex-offenders be given information and or assistance in regaining their voting rights at the time they complete their sentence. 12 states simplified the process for regaining voting rights, for instance, by eliminating a waiting period or streamlining the paperwork process. While this bill falls short of a constitutional amendment to eliminate the voting prohibition entirely, it does limit disenfranchisement to those incarcerated and restores voting rights upon release. A hallmark of participatory democracy, voting affirms our membership in the social compact. Exclusion of criminal offenders from this process and from one of the most fundamental rituals of community involvement does nothing to promote public safety and reduce recidivism. It can only serve to impede social reintegration of these citizens. Felon disenfranchisement statutes rest on an outdated retributory practices, antithetical to contemporary standards of equal representation in the political process, standards explicitly stated in the Voting Rights Act, that would be of 1965. Former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall said, "It is doubtful whether a state can demonstrate either a compelling or a rational policy interest in denying former felons the right to vote. Ex-offenders have already paid their debt to society. They are as much affected by the actions of government as any other citizen and have as much a right to participate in government decision-making. Furthermore, the denial of a right to vote to such persons is hindrance to the efforts of society to rehabilitate former felons and convert them into law-abiding and productive citizens." If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. And by the way, I would mention that I just received the fiscal note on the bill, and they are 0 fiscal notes as to this bill, which would involve both corrections and the division of elections.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Obermeyer. Are there questions? Yes, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Obermeyer, for your presentation. Just a couple questions, and I think this might have come up last year. How do you define moral turpitude?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I provided a copy of a document to you under a green tab, and it it is defined under a statute, 1580.0109. It's on page 2 of that statute, which is probably the 5th page behind that staple package.
Okay, so it's the handout that's on our table?
Yes, and it's fairly extensive. I was concerned about the definition of moral turpitude, and it involves those crimes that are immoral or wrong themselves, such as murder, you know, which again is fairly vague, but they describe dozens of these crimes. So on the contrary, when I received information from the Division of Elections, which is the first 3 pages of the handout regarding processing felons, the second page has on the at the bottom, or in the middle of the page, felony charges not involving moral turpitude per the AG's office responses. Now, I don't know if that's complete, and there are no statutory references to that document. I called Alpheus Bullard, who is the drafter of this, and asked if, and only this morning I asked him, he's online, I don't know if he had a chance to check, but I don't know if there is a statutory reference to felonies not involving moral turpitude, but perhaps Ms. Carpinetti, who's in the room from the Department of Law, could address that. But those are some of the felonies that would not involve moral turpitude.
Okay, that helps a lot, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, also if I do have another question, if I can continue.
Yes, please.
Can you define unconditional discharge? I'm assuming, like, if you're discharged but you're still on probation, you would still not be allowed to vote or be a juror?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, we do have Ms. Carmen Gutierrez, who is the deputy commissioner at DOC. It might be a better answer to that question. I know that some of these technicalities would seem initially a little vague as to how you would define incarcerated or, you know, what full discharges or what isn't. But the purpose of this bill is to let felony offenders, misdemeanants are not involved in this, vote immediately upon release from prison. That's before any parole, disabilities due to parole or probation or retribution or any other issues.
exactly, Mr. Chairman, but it seems like the person really hasn't served their full term if they still have probation or still on parole.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the reason that that many states have changed this is the fact that probation is a historic process of allowing people to perform while they're out of prison and give them an opportunity to show that they're going to continue walking the correct path. The only way to really administer this bill easily through both corrections and division of elections, in my opinion, is to release them, is to let them, give them the right to vote immediately. If they violate their probation, wait until there's an order that they're reincarcerated and then take their voting rights away. But to assume that they haven't served their sentence just because they're on probation or parole is not, I don't think, entirely correct. I am a little, I'm only concerned about, you know, whether or not it would be determined that parole is maybe an early release, but they've served good time in order to get a parole. You know, they have demonstrated good behavior in prison in order to even get parole. So they would tend to be a better citizen when they get out. That is the rationale behind it. But, you know, perhaps the Division of Elections and the Department can better address these narrow issues.
Mr. Chairman, I'll yes, conclude my questions, but I guess I have a little bit of concern that somebody who may be released out of prison and is still on parole, for example, for providing alcohol to minors, can now be a juror and hear a case dealing with somebody providing alcohol to minors. And I'm not sure I'm totally comfortable with somebody being on probation for that crime now being one of the jurors, but... Thank you.
Any response, Mr. Obermeyer?
Well, through the chair, my only response would be that I can't assume what people are going to do once they're released. They're capable of doing anything. We'd like to think that in the rehabilitative process, if we're really going to, and by the way, there are millions of these people living among us. There are thousands in Alaska that are your neighbors and other people that may have been a felon. But the point is that we don't assume that they're going to do the wrong thing when they leave. We're assuming by giving them the right to vote that they're going to want to do the right thing in order to reintegrate back into society. The concept here is all positive rather than negative, and in order to have, you know, a continued retribution against them when they leave, it hinders the process of trying to get them back into the society.
All right, thank you. Senator Geisel.
Well, I just wanted to underscore the concerns that Senator Meyer just expressed. Some of the other felonies that involve moral turpitude are sexual abuse, incest, perjury, endangering the welfare of a minor, prostitution, child pornography. Some of these crimes, while we hope they won't be repeated after release, we know there's a high recidivism rate. The misuse of controlled substances is one of those, sexual abuse, pornography, these all have high recidivism rates. And so to simply say that, well, they're out on probation, let's restore their right to vote, I would have concern about that. As I look at the law currently in Alaska, after they've completed their parole or probation, their voting rights are restored. And according to the numbers we were given on the fiscal note, in the years 2008 and 2009, more than 17,000 citizens were restored their voting rights because they completed parole and probation. So it's not that this is a lifetime prohibition. People do restore their voting rights. So that would be my concern. Do you see that recidivism rate, especially with the sexual crimes?
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, I don't see this as a problem. I really don't. I mean, the fact that Maine and Vermont don't even take the voting rights away, I think it shows this whole thing goes back really about 400 years. I mean, the concept of just taking people's rights away completely. And I will point out that the Alaska Constitution is pointing toward, in corrections, a model of rehabilitation and reformation, and also we have to restore the civil rights of people in order for them to be able to vote, and there are other issues that involve that, but in order to look at some of the statistics that come out of the Department of Corrections here, and I didn't read it quite the same way you did, but as I understand the procedure from the Division of Elections, which was part of that handout, they're given information that would permit the felon the right to apply for their voting restoration again. In the past, just so you understand the contrast, they had to ask the Department of Corrections for what they called a white paper in order to then go back to the department, the Division of Elections, to get the right to vote. Very cumbersome. With modern computers and knowing who's where and what type of felonies and so forth, they can do this very easily and send this over to the Division of Elections. And the Division of Elections can change the coding on the computer so that they're no longer a felon disenfranchised, but one without that disability. And so I don't see that as a particular problem. The number of people who are involved in this actually may not be as great as we think. As to those that will actually run out immediately after prison and apply to vote, I have no idea. But the idea of letting them think that all at once that they are a restored member of society is enormous, I think, psychologically for these people. They have a tremendous burden coming out of prison to find work. You've mentioned recidivism. And the fact that they think that they now have been given another right back, I think, will encourage them to continue on the right trail. And I might mention that I just received from the ACLU last night, and I think you may have the document from Jeffrey Mittman, who indicated that that the number of people that who have been re-enfranchised, they have proven a link between voting participation and reoffense. People, I quote, who, this is on bottom of page 2, who voted after release from supervision were half as likely to be rearrested as those who did not vote. Similar effects were found among people with a prior arrest. 27% of non-voters were rearrested compared to 12% who had voted. I mean, I don't know if, you
do
know.
Do you
if
have
the,
that document?
Do you I don't know if you have this, but I sent this to Michelle last night.
I saw it come
up. Actually, it came through to both. I take that back. It came to everybody's office, but it came late. I've been asking all day for Mittman, who was at a national conference, to give me a letter.
I saw it came in my email box late last night. I don't know that it made it into the packet. We can get copies and provide that for the committee, though. Are there any other questions by the committee? And I'll just say, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I know we had a good discussion on it last year. I think it's an important discussion to have. I think what we've been doing in the past clearly has not worked. We have we continue to have 66% recidivism in our state. We're basically a revolving door. And if most states are moving towards rehabilitative models, this is certainly worth a good discussion. And I think it is a good discussion today to try to figure out if this is something that will help bring people back into society as good, productive members of society. So if there are no other questions of the bill sponsor, we have Annie Carpinetti, who I believe we're going to lose at 9:30. So if you could step forward and if you have any testimony. Welcome to the committee. If you could put yourself on the record.
My name is Annie Carpinetti. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I think my issues with this bill are not philosophical, really, but more legal. Although I will say that the Criminal Division does have a little concern about people who are recently released from incarceration serving on juries. We have a limited number of peremptory challenges under the court rules, and we would be sorry to see the necessity if we felt well, for example, our court rules now provide that you're not even qualified to serve as a juror if you've been on the opposite side of a case with another person within the last 2 years. This is a little bit different, but you know, philosophically, I understand the sponsors' concerns, and I share them. I mean, we want people not to be in a revolving door, but I think the legal issue is a tough one to deal with in this case, because our Constitution is really clear. It says you don't have a right to vote until your civil rights have been restored, and I think that's a tough question, because serving on a jury is certainly one of your civil rights. Carrying possessing a handgun that's capable of being concealed on your person is another, and you can't do that in our state at this point. And then the very fact that you're on probation and parole really do restrict your civil rights. You can be subject to search without a warrant. You can be arrested by your probation or parole officer on probable cause without a warrant from a judicial officer. There are lots of limitations involved in being on probation and parole that I think are included in your civil rights, and the Constitution says you can't vote until you get them back. So I just have these concerns that I wanted you to know about, and I don't have a lot of answers, but I do have concerns about it, and I'll be happy to do whatever you like me to do, but I don't know if there are answers given what's in our Constitution.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Meyer.
Annie, thank you so much for coming forward, and I think you answered some of the questions that I had. Well, you know, one was that if you're still on probation, isn't that still part of your sentence? And I think you said that it is.
Through the chair, yes, the judge can orders you to a sentence, and some of it's suspended on various conditions, and you're on probation or probation according to the conditions that are set for you. So that really does limit your civil rights. Can't move without permission. You can't. You have to report to your probation officer. That, you know, it depends on what conditions are set for you, but those are pretty, they can be pretty onerous.
And Mr. Chairman, as you said too, it is more philosophical, but the voting part doesn't bother me as much as someone serving on a jury, for example, and still being on probation for a certain crime. But then again, now that I think about it, don't you have to wait? You have to wait a while before you're selected in the jury process, or how do you become part of the jury pool?
Through the chair, I think you become part of the jury pool by virtue of getting a permanent fund dividend, applying for a permanent fund dividend. That's, I think, where they take the names of potential jurors from the permanent fund dividend application list.
Yeah, and then, Mr. Chairman, so if you're serving a sentence, you don't get a PFD, correct?
Through the chair, I think it depends. For most felonies, I think they're suspended, but I would have to double-check the statute on that.
I'm just thinking it could be up to a year before you could be eligible to be selected for a jury anyway once you're out of. But you could still be on probation, I suppose.
Sure, yeah. And I want to emphasize that we don't have any philosophical position right now at this point on whether it's a good idea for felons that are incarcerated or out of incarceration to vote, but I just want to tell you some of the practical issues that we see.
Ms. Carpenter, if you could point me to the section in the Constitution you're referring to.
It's Article 5, Section 2.
Okay, and I'll just read it for the committee. No person may vote who has been convicted of a felony involving moral turpitude unless his civil rights have been restored. No person may vote who has been judicially determined to be of unsound mind unless the disability has been removed. So the question is, when are the civil rights restored? And in your opinion, they're restored when the probationary period or parole is completed?
Well, under current law, a person who's been convicted of a felony can vote when the conditions of probation and parole have been satisfied. That definition is in statute 1255-185 defines that when the conditions of probation and parole are removed. And then that, by operation of law, a person can go register to vote at that point.
Are they, when a person is released from parole or probation, are they automatically restored, or is there a process where they have to go and fill out paperwork?
I believe they just have to go register. But, you know, I could be corrected by people who are in the Division of Elections. But I think it's by operation of law they can just go register.
Okay. Other questions for Ms. Carpinetti? And you're under time constraint, I understand, so I appreciate you coming down here.
Thank you very
much. Okay, thank you. I would like the bill sponsor to, Mr. Obermeyer, if you could just come back and walk us through the bill real quick.
Let me go through the sectional analysis, if I could. Section 1 changes Title 920.020 to provide that a person who has been convicted of a felony may not serve as a juror while incarcerated for that crime, instead of being disqualified from serving as a juror until the person's unconditional discharge, meaning convicted of a crime, is released from all disability arriving under a sentence, including probation and parole. Section 2.
And Mr. Obermeyer, if I could just pause for 1 second. Same question I asked Ms. Carpinetti. The unconditional discharge, does that automatically happen, or is that something a person would need to go and apply to have themselves unconditionally discharged?
Through the chair. The disability would have to be removed by the Department of Corrections, and they would. They send information over on a regular basis to the Division of Elections that they change the coding of this person's status on their computer system. And then it's up, if they give notice, and we're hoping they do and they will under this bill, walking out the door instead of waiting for a white paper later that may come through, the person will have to go reapply at the Division of Elections that they are now able to vote. And in the past, this happens after all disabilities would be imposed. And I think these disabilities can not only involve probation and parole, but in some cases restitution as well, maybe to victims or whatever is necessary to try to make amends. The rationale behind this bill, though, is they've been punished pretty severely if they've gone to prison. We have 5,300 prisoners in prisons in this state right now. And once they're out, in order to discourage their going back, we would like them to be able to vote right away. And this probationary period is really to try to keep them on track, have somebody check up on them, make sure that they know what they're doing. And I think that could happen while they have the right to vote. I don't see where that's a particular problem, that they are somehow still incarcerated, they still have the disability of being incarcerated and punished in prison. That's the reason so many states have changed their rules on this. And frankly, the rehabilitative model is not working. I've had people call us from out of state. We have over 800 prisoners, I think, out of state, at least we have had. And an older gentleman who was in for 11 years said, these young people sitting here are doing nothing. He said, I'm calling you for that reason. He said this might have been their very first drug offense. They get 5 years, and they're just wasting away here. So I think there is a reason why we need to get these people back into society and be productive. And it may be much more than just voting rights.
Okay. Section 2?
Section 2 changes 1505-30 to provide that a person convicted of a crime that constitutes a felony involving moral turpitude under state or federal law may not vote while incarcerated for that crime instead of being disqualified as a voter until the person's unconditional discharge. Again, you may need the department to discuss this as well as law. It provides that a person who has been incarcerated will be advised of voter registration requirements and procedures upon release, and that the Commissioner of Corrections will notify the Director of Elections that the person is entitled to be registered as a voter. Section 3 changes 1505-135 to provide that the voter registration of a person convicted of a crime that constitutes a felony involving moral turpitude will be canceled only when that person is incarcerated instead of until that person's unconditional discharge from custody. And Section 4 changes 3330-241A to provide that a person convicted of a crime that constitutes a felony involving moral turpitude under state or federal law is disqualified from voting while incarcerated for that time instead of being disqualified from voting until a person's unconditional discharge.
Let me just pause you there. Section 4, why are you adding federal on line 28?
And you know, that was a question that I had. I think Alpheus Bullard, who's online, might be able to answer that. I was a little concerned about why the state is involved with. We do have many of our felony offenders, and in fact, most of these drug offenses are federal offenses, wind up being housed. In state prisons for state offenses, and I guess federal prisons for federal offenses. Maybe Ms. Carpentini could answer that too. But they are exposed to two types of statutes, and so maybe Mr. Bullard could answer that question. I don't know.
I'll ask. Let's wrap up with you, and then get to Mr. Bullard.
Fine, thank you. Section 5 changes 3330-241B to provide a person convicted of a felony is disqualified from serving as a juror while that person is incarcerated instead of being disqualified as a juror until the person's unconditional discharge. And that was one of the issues that came up this morning. Section 6 repeals 1560-01039, a definition of unconditional discharge, and 3330-241C, a definition of unconditional discharge as used in AS 3241. That might have answered your question, and I apologize. I don't have the statutes with me to go to that definition.
Okay, I can ask Mr. Bullard about that. All right, any final questions for the bill sponsor? All right, Alpheus, are you there? Alpheus Bullard?
Good morning.
Hi, Alpheus.
Members of the committee, Chair, yes, I am here.
You could put yourself on the record, please, and I'll have a question about Sections 4 and Section 6. My question on Section 4 is, why are we adding the word federal on line 28?
For the record, this is Alpheus Bullard. I'm an attorney with Ledge Legal. And in response to the first question from the Chair, federal is added at line 28 of page 2 of this draft to create a consistent standard. If someone is able to vote for governor or for mayor, they should probably be able to vote for their senator as well.
Right. What is the law as it stands right now? You're unable to vote in the federal election?
You know, I do not believe that you are able to vote in a federal election. I do not know why the word federal was previously not included here.
Do they have separate ballots for people who are unconditionally? Let's see. So right now, a felon can vote in the federal election, but not in a state or municipal election?
Members of the committee, through my chair, it is my understanding that a felon cannot vote in a federal election and that there is no special ballot for federal elections provided for persons who have not been unconditionally discharged. But the question might be best answered by a member of the Division of Elections.
Okay. And then on Section 6, we're repealing AS 3330-241C. If you could tell us what that section is, please.
Thank you. members of the committee, 33-30-241C is a conforming reference to the definition of unconditional discharge that's found at 1255-185.
Okay. And then, Alpheus, can you give us your opinion? We heard from Ms. Carpinetti. She had questions about whether or not this change, about this, whether or not this bill would violate the Alaska Constitution, Article 5, Section 2. Do you have an opinion on that?
I do not have a legal opinion on that. Article 5, Section 2 of the Constitution provides that a person who has been convicted of a felony involving moral turpitude cannot vote until their civil rights have been restored. What civil rights being restored for the purpose of this this article and clause has really not been explored by our state courts.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Bullard? All right. Seeing none, let's move on. We've got other thank you. Thank you, Alpheus. Okay. We have Carmen Gutierrez from Department of Corrections. If you could come forward, please, put yourself on the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Carmen Gutierrez. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections, responsible for prisoner rehabilitation and reentry. I appreciate the opportunity this morning to provide comments and would be more than happy to answer any questions that this committee may have. If I may, first, by way of introduction, I would like the committee to know that the Department of Corrections in this administration is very committed to upholding our constitutional responsibility to provide reformative programs for people who are under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections. It's not only required by the Constitution, but it's also required by state statute. We are currently engaged in a number of efforts to provide rehabilitative services, both by way of substance abuse and educational vocational programs in our institutions. And so when it comes to any initiative that has its purpose to be to help successfully reintegrate people releasing from prison back into our communities, we are very supportive of those kind of efforts to reintegrate former prisoners. I think it's important for all Alaska legislators to know that in Alaska in 2008, we were releasing from prison 287 convicted felons every month into Alaska's communities. That number went up to 298 in 2009. So the fact of the matter is we have a lot of people leaving custody who have the title, the stigma, however you wish to see it, as being a convicted felon. And if those individuals are not successfully reintegrated into their communities, they are coming back. The 2007 Judicial Council study shows, as Senator Welikowski attested to, that we have a recidivism rate of 66%. That means two out of three people come back within the first 3 years of their release, and most of those individuals come back within the first year. With regard to the bill specifically, on page 2, under subsection B, or B, section B, subsection 2, it states the Commissioner of Corrections shall notify the director that the person is entitled to be registered. We have some concern about the language is entitled to be registered because it appears that the commissioner is being asked to render a legal opinion. It may be better stated that the person has been released from custody. So as to the actual language of the bill, that is one concern we would like to note for the record. With regard to the impact that this may have on the department, in an attempt to answer a question that I believe was previously raised, when an individual is unconditionally discharged from probation, which means that individual has satisfied his or her conditions of probation and is prepared to be released from formal supervision, the Department of Probation issues a notice stating so both to the probationer and to the Division of Elections. And so we do that today when the individual has satisfied his or her conditions of probation. I think it may be helpful, and if I'm going on too long on issues that are not of interest to the committee, please let me know. But I think that people often don't understand the difference between parole and probation. In Alaska, we have two different kinds of parole. We have mandatory parole and discretionary parole. Discretionary parole is when an individual submits an application to the parole board and is requesting that he or she be released early from prison because they have done good rehabilitative work inside the institution, they've had a great record of abiding by the rules, they have demonstrated remorse, etc. There's a whole process. When a person is released on discretionary parole, that essentially means that they were sentenced to a term of prison by the judge. The parole board has found it appropriate in this case to release that person early from their jail sentence term. That's discretionary parole. Mandatory parole is, in Alaska, most offenders receive the benefit of good time credit, and that's one quarter of your sentence is reduced for good behavior in prison. For that amount of time that you're released early for good behavior, you are on what is called mandatory parole. Mandatory parole and probation are basically served at the same time. When the individual finishes the period of mandatory parole, they're then on formal probation. Formal probation can be anywhere from 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, depending upon the offender and the gravity of the offense. When the person finishes probation, then they are unconditionally discharged. In 2008, the Department of Corrections released just over 1,700 people on parole and almost 7,000 onto probation. Those numbers were up a little bit in 2009. Almost 2,000 were released on parole, and almost 6,700 plus onto probation. Today we have about 6,000 individuals on probation, and according to the most recent report that I received from our Director of Probation, approximately 850 of those individuals are on what we call abscond status, meaning they are no longer reporting to their probation officers. A warrant has been issued for their arrest. They have absconded. So I think the question is for this committee is to consider whether or not voting rights should be restored to individuals who are on abscond status. The second issue for consideration is in Anchorage, we did a snapshot review of how many individuals our Anchorage Probation Office filed a petition to revoke on. That's an individual who has failed to comply with his or her conditions of probation, and the probation officer, after working with that individual, comes to the point where they decide, we need to file with the court a petition to revoke your probation. In Anchorage, over a six-month period, my review revealed that our Anchorage Probation Department was filing between 178 to 200 petitions to revoke probation every month, and that's in Anchorage alone. When a petition to revoke probation is filed, sometimes the individual is arrested quickly, sometimes not. They are then brought to jail. Sometimes they bail out. Sometimes they do not. So there could be a certain amount of record-keeping logistics on verifying who's in, who's now, who's out, and sometimes people are coming in and out with some frequency. So I think that's just something to be aware of in understanding the number of people who are being revoked and how they are initially arrested, then released on bail, and then maybe sentenced to a period of incarceration. So those are the comments that the Department of Corrections would like to offer on the proposed legislation. And again, I would echo the testimony of Annie Carpinetti in spirit. The Department of Corrections is very supportive of all efforts that are consistent with preserving public safety in reintegrating prisoners releasing from custody. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And let me just ask you a question on, we have a letter of support from the ACLU, and in their letter they say that recent research finds a link between voting participation and reoffense. People who voted after release from supervision were half as likely to be rearrested as those who did not. Similar effects were found among people with a prior arrest. 27% of non-voters were rearrested compared with 12% of people who had voted. Do you have any, does the department have an, do you agree with those numbers? Do you have any research or opinion on whether or not those are accurate or would apply here in Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, last night I had an opportunity to ask whether or not there was any research nationally on the issue of to what extent does the restoration of voting rights help within offenders' rehabilitation and reintegration. I sent a query to a consultant that the Department of Corrections has been working on our prisoner reentry efforts. She was unaware of this research or any other research to that effect. I would like to look at the research that has just been provided and review it for myself. I think it's very, very interesting and compelling. But before I comment on something that I haven't had an opportunity to review for myself, I'd like to reserve that comment.
And from my position, if we can restore people's voting rights and potentially reduce recidivism by, well, this says half. I don't know if you get it down that much, but a few percentage points, you're talking millions of dollars, I would assume, in savings to the Department of Corrections.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it's amazing. I mean, even if we can cut recidivism by 10% off the 66, it is a huge saving to the state, but most importantly, it's a huge saving to the citizens of our community because, by and large, when any individual who is committing a new crime has created a new victim. And by successfully reintegrating people into the communities, we make our communities safer and healthier.
And so I would ask if you could check with your consultant and see if they have any, if they agree with this research, and I'd ask the bill sponsor as well if we could maybe get really bored out on that, because to me that would be a very compelling reason to pass this piece of legislation if we can reduce recidivism and prevent future crimes. I think that would really be something that we could do as a state to have a positive impact here. Other questions by the committee? Let me just ask you on when a person is finishes their parole and finishes their probation, are they automatically unconditionally discharged, or is there paperwork they need to fill out?
Mr. Chairman, when a person has satisfied the conditions of their probation, they are given a document that states they're unconditionally discharged and no longer on probation. And we provide that same notice to the Division of Elections. So at that point, that individual is then free to go to the Division of Elections and register to vote just like any other citizen.
And do you see any problems with the provision in Section 2 of the bill that requires you to provide the person written notification that their voting rights have been restored?
Mr. Chairman, the department is doing that today, so I don't see, the department does not view that as an additional burden of any kind.
Okay. Any other questions? Great. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
We have a few people who have been waiting very patiently online, and I'd like to move to those witnesses at this time. We have Dr. Patterson. Dr. Patterson, if you could put yourself on the record, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Alonzo Patterson, service pastor of Shiloh Baptist Church. I am chair of the state MLK Foundation, along with the Alaska Black Leadership Conference. And I have served in the state with our parole system for some 13 years, and I've had some experience with the release of inmates back in society and work among a lot of disempowered persons that are in our system now that constitutes, to a large degree, a persuasiveness to be brought back into the system because of a lack of feeling a part of society. My appearance today is to register in hope that you will strongly consider the right to vote on the part of those persons who have been released in the immediacy. One of the problems I feel we have is that while persons are indeed released from incarceration, back into society, they feel a sense of hopelessness because they have no ownership in that society. The institution says that you are rehabilitated and you are restored. You asked a question earlier, when has one fulfilled his obligation to society? And we know that based upon technicalities within the law, that can go on for years. What constitutes a felon? In some cases, it's a technicality. Other cases, it's a hardcore criminal behavior that needs to be looked at. So I want to go on record as being supportive of felons having, even though you're a felon, whatever that constitutes in the law, you have your rights are restored to vote. I agree with some earlier testimony that once an individual comes back in society, feel like they are treated as a human being again, they do take on ownership of that society, and they do feel a sense of hope of being restored to that society. Short of that, they are forced into a box where they are. One cannot get a job without telling people what their past has been, that they've been a felon, and therefore society immediately turns them off because they are stigmatized and stereotyped, forcing them into non-employment, non-equity of the common rights of our society, and thus forcing them to recidivate, and therefore continuing the obligation of the state to house them for us. So I'm of the opinion, and based upon my experience with the parole system, that those inmates who are released in society and given a right to feel or encouraged to feel like they are once again a part of their society will indeed recidivate less, will take some of the economic burden off of society, and will indeed become an integral part of society. What is rehabilitation? We believe that when you go to the mandatory release, that that is a degree of rehabilitation. And it's a part of the system by the state to bring a person back to full citizenship. I'm in support of that. One final comment I would make, although I realize the distinction between a television judge and one that is sitting on the bench, but there are judges serving and making decisions in people's lives now on the benches who boast about the fact that they've been in the institution and they did all these crimes and now they are out, and some of them are serving as judges and lawyers, etc. I just believe, and I want to go on record as being supportive of the inmates who have become felons and have been released back to society, that they have their rights restored to them to vote. I think it serves to the better of the state rather than as a negative technicality on what may happen. We already know that if one is going to recidivate, it doesn't matter whether you're a felon or whatever.
Are there questions? All right. Seeing none, Dr. Patterson, thank you so much for your testimony and for your leadership. Let's move next to Cal Williams.
Thank you very much. I am Cal Williams here in Anchorage, Alaska. I am currently the third vice president of the Anchorage unit of the NAACP. I am chairman of the political action committee of that organization. In a past life, I served as a commissioner on the Prison Industries Commission, and certainly have been from that time prior, actually, for prisoner rehabilitation and for that corrective nature that's supposed to take place in our correctional institutions to return these people to productive citizens. And as testified here today by numerous people, the right to vote is certainly a key a proponent of being a full-fledged citizen and buying into our system and feeling a part ownership of that system. So I don't want to be redundant. I certainly am very pleased that Senator Davis has put the work in on this, and her staffer, Mr. Thomas Obermeyer, has clearly pointed out all of the advantages of passing this bill. It is supported by ACLU with good data that they have provided. I was hoping that and she very well may be online, our executive director, Ms. Hillary Sheldon, I hope she's online, because I was hoping to just follow her and say that we here locally support what she and the national office of the NAACP stands for, rehabilitation and certainly the reintegration into society, full citizenship, so that young people, some of them caught up in minor drug offenses that go on to be magnified by being incarcerated with others and participating in crimes perhaps while in jail. We've got young people who've gone in with a minor infraction coming out with all kinds of knowledge and antisocial attitude. We support positive change that will bring about a productive citizen who will be contributing to society as opposed to being further ostracized by our system. And I certainly want to support this bill, the passage of this bill.
Cal, thank you for your testimony. Appreciate what you're doing. Okay, next up we have Troy Bruckner.
Yes, hi, this is Troy Buckner, the president and CEO of the Anchorage Urban League. And, you know, I don't want to be redundant as Kyle Williams just said. And, I echo everything Reverend Patterson said. Just a couple points, though, on this issue. The Anchorage Urban League is the affiliate of a 101-year-old civil rights organization. Our focus is economic educational parity with people of color and for people in general. One thing that we do regularly is we work with folks in the reentry arena. A lot of times what we see is, as people have been saying, a disconnect, because there's beyond just the voting issue, it's part of a bigger issue where there's legalized discrimination in housing, in education, in employment. And what we say is when a person is convicted of a felony, whether they get charged or whether they, get sentenced to 1 year or 5 years or 10 years, whatever the charge is, if there's no voting rights, they're actually getting a life sentence. So, as has been stated, this is something that follows them for the rest of their life, regardless of the size and the extent and the nature of their crime. And so, we're saying, and we support this legislation, we applaud the senator for raising it again, and we just want to express the point of, we're talking about civil rights. We're supposed to be a democratic society, a democratic country. We see a move around the world right now, today, for people who are standing up for their right to vote, their right to choose their leadership and their, the direction of their community. We'd also like to point to the recent book released by Michelle Alexander called The New Jim Crow. And one of the main points in this book is that today there are more African-Americans in jail, prison, parole, and probation than there were in slavery in 1850. You know, and this is something that is a serious hindrance on our community. Again, we support this effort, and anything that we can do to further along, we're here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bruckner. Is there anyone else online wanting to testify? On this bill, Senate Bill 7? Okay, hearing none. Is there anyone in the room wanting to testify? Okay, hearing none, we'll close public testimony. Okay, we're going to set the bill aside, and there have been some questions that have come up. If the bill sponsor could work with maybe some of the committee members and see if there are solutions or ways that we can overcome some of the concerns that have been raised, and also with the Department of Corrections, also be interested in seeing that any of the studies that have been done on the recidivism rates for people that vote versus those that don't vote. I think that's very compelling evidence. And with that, I thank the bill sponsor again for bringing this to us. Okay, let's move on to our next bill. Is Senate Bill 30, and it's an act regarding the return of property in the custody of a law enforcement agency. Bill sponsored by Senator Dyson. Senator Dyson, welcome to the committee. If you could put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for granting this hearing. This bill kind of continues the pattern you're on this morning of restorative justice. With me is my chief of staff, Chuck Kopp, who was 25 years in law enforcement, chief of police in Kenai. When I first got here some years ago, a good friend of mine, Ethan Berkowitz and Eric Croft, and I worked on really doing what we could to get our laws reflecting this philosophy of restorative justice, which is aimed at restoring the victim to a pre-offense condition to the degree possible, and also restoring the perpetrator if possible. Last year we had an identical bill, SB 297, and I think it got through judiciary with three due passes and didn't get any further. This bill is designed to further enhance the process of returning property to victims whose property has been seized as a result of a crime. I have some anecdotes, but if you'll look at the existing law, and that's 1236.020, you'll see that a few years ago the legislature put in a separate paragraph that says that what's been stolen is commercial fishing nets, that the law needs to get back to returning those so that fishermen can go back fishing. And when the fish are running, the clock is running. I have a few anecdotes. I got most recently stirred up about this when a custom boat maker builder in Anchorage had a $300,000 boat. He was building a commercial boat. Two guys walked in during the process, talking particularly about future business. That night, $40,000 worth of electronics sitting on the floor in boxes disappeared. He's a bright guy, called cops, cops came. He got on Craigslist, started visiting the pawn shops, got about two-thirds of it back from those. Police served it as evidence, and some of the rest of it was recovered a bit later. Nonetheless, it stayed in the evidence locker. He had to go out and repurchase the $40,000 worth of gear that was very specific to this vessel and significantly inhibited or was negative to his bottom line. When I was working on this bill, I was talking with Tam Cook across the street, and she told me of a single mother here in Juneau. Car was stolen, and it was 2.5 years getting it back. She was on a pretty limited income, and that's a problem. So I know a lot of general dirt moving contractors in Anchorage, and a couple of them told them that years ago they quit reporting the theft of dirt moving equipment because they needed the equipment for the job through their network of friends and so on. They often knew where the equipment went and repossessed it themselves outside of law enforcement just to get the equipment back that was needed on the job. I'm going to let my chief of staff explain the details of this and the support we've gotten. So this is Mr. Cobb.
Morning, members of the committee, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Meyer, Senator Diesel. Thank you for hearing this legislation. To give you a brief analysis of this bill, essentially what it does is it provides a right of hearing to property owners to request a hearing for the return of their property, and then requires a law enforcement agency to request a hearing before the court within 10 days of receiving that notice that an owner would like a hearing. That does not say when the court will be able to calendar the hearing or when they can actually have the hearing, but it just requires that an action be taken, that a hearing request be submitted to the court. And it further provides that the court may return the property upon satisfactory proof of ownership and the law enforcement agency proves that neither they nor any other interested party has a right of possession that exceeds that of the property owner. That would include any changes in the law, such as last session's 1236-200, the preservation of DNA evidence that involve all the crimes of murder and the crimes of sexual assault, first degree, and sexual abuse of a minor. There are a number of things that the law currently says are just prohibitive. You can't have it back if it's evidence of that crime. But as the law changes, the law enforcement agency would be in that position to show that to the court and to other interested parties at that hearing that they can or cannot have it back. And the law enforcement agency in this section is defined as any agency that is involved with the prosecution of the law or the enforcement of criminal law, so necessarily it would also include the Office of District Attorney. And finally, it provides that the court may impose reasonable conditions on an owner claiming property. And this can be very important in crimes against businesses, and it's primarily the business community that we're interested on this juncture, because often from commercial job sites, whether it's heavy equipment or it's generators that are stolen, things that push the property value up above $500, which now makes it a felony, the practical reality is the Department of Law can get nervous once they know the property value is up to a felony level of offense, and the police are often cast in the role as advocates for the business owners. They have found it, or it has been found, turned over to law enforcement. We'd like to get it back to the property owner as quickly as possible, but there may be resistance, not necessarily from the Department of Law, but it can be from the defense if we have a suspect in custody or another third party for various reasons of why they don't want that to immediately go back. So what this provides is that the court may impose a reasonable condition on the return of that property, such as you can continue to use it, but we don't want you to lease it or sell it because it is part of this case until resolution. You know, we understand it's important to your business, but so that could be an example of a reasonable condition that the court may impose. Why this law is important is right now there is not provided a right of hearing for property owners. They would have civil recourse. They could sue if they were unable to get agreement between the involved entities as to return of their property, but that does impose a heavy burden on victims to have to sue to get their property back. And the law seems to recognize that there is a problem, as Senator Dyson pointed out earlier, when it says in section 1245.086, which is the laws that talk about photographing properly and returning evidence, it says that if the prosecution is for theft in any degree and that theft involves commercial fishing gear, the agency shall return that to the owner as soon as possible. And we are just simply saying that we suggest that most businesses would like their property returned as soon as possible, whether they're a commercial fisherman or not. So this introduces to the law this hearing process to recover possession. It allows the court to be a referee of that process in those situations where they just can't seem to get agreement. This bill was supported last year by the Alaska Peace Officers Association and the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights, and also we have Director Victor Kester online to give his testimony from the Office of Victims' Rights. And finally, the intent of this is to not do anything to jeopardize a prosecution of a case, as we highlight in a sponsor statement, but mainly to just make sure that evidence is only held as long as necessary for prosecution and the defense to physically retain the item without jeopardizing the case, and giving the owners a right to a hearing in those situations where they just can't seem to come to agreement on getting their property back. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions? Okay, seeing none. I do have some, a couple questions, and thank you for bringing this forward. I think this is, I think this, we need to change the way we're doing business. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. Let me ask you a question. The case up in the valley where the dogs were seized, there were 50 dogs killed, 100 dogs were seized. If they're currently in custody right now, could that owner under this bill go ahead and request custody back and get them back, or how would that work?
Yeah, under this bill, that owner could request this. This does not prohibit an owner who is a suspect or a defendant in a case from requesting a hearing. The rules of evidence would clearly prohibit that if the trial is pending, if the matter is still pending in court, there's no judge that's going to allow them to have it back. It does give them the right to request a hearing. And how I would see this played out, Senator Wilkowski, is the judge would calendar a hearing, because that's what the law says, but he would probably calendar it post, after the trial date. And because that's all the law requires, is that a hearing date be set. And the court may very well return his advice through counsel that because the owner in this case is a defendant, that they have no intention of releasing the evidence.
How would the judge analyze in that case whether or not, I mean, what's the standard for determining whether or not, for instance, in that case, the owner would get his dogs back? If we pass, because right now he can't, I guess he just can't go to court, or he could file a civil suit right now, you're saying?
Yeah, and I don't know all the details of the specific case, but I can tell you how the court often makes those determinations is they will talk to both counsel, and the court can determine the weight of the evidence that the state has against a person, and the court can make its own judgment on whether or not they think there's a good case, or whether or not they think this person has a pretty good defense or plausible explanations for the condition of those dogs. Let's say, and maybe the court believes that this person should be allowed to have maybe some dogs back, maybe not all, maybe there are some overwhelming circumstances, but the court can make some individual judgments in matters like that.
So currently a person can file a civil lawsuit and get possession back? And this would change it to what? How?
This basically gives a person a right of a court hearing without having to file a civil suit in those circumstances where their only option is if they have the recourse to sue civilly, they can do that. Many people don't have those resources, so this provides in the law a method to be able to do that. And also the very last section of this bill says that the court may impose reasonable conditions on an owner claiming property under this section. And what that does is that allows the court to address the very situation you have put forward, Senator, that the court can say, you know, under this circumstance or under the weight of the evidence or in this situation, I will or will not allow property to be returned.
So the way I'm reading this, the way this appears to work is, just sticking on this case with Mr. Rich and the dogs, the owner of the property may request that the agency return the property. So he would go to the agent, and who would the agency be in that particular case?
The agency, as defined in the terms in under Chapter 36, disposition of recovered or seized property, includes any agency that's responsible for the enforcement or the prosecution of the law. So that would include both the law enforcement agency, be it municipal or state, and the Department of Law.
So he would go to the Department of Law, and then under this law, the department would be required to go to court to determine if the property should be released?
They're required to request a hearing before the court to determine if the property shall be released to the owner. So once the court receives that request for hearing, they would calendar it at their discretion.
And that is that the criminal court or the civil court at that point?
Well, if it was a criminal case, my imagine a superior court judge could hear both matters. It may be delegated to a district court.
And then just in terms of the, I'm looking at the fiscal note, it's got an indeterminate fiscal note. I mean, I guess I'd be interested in hearing, is there someone from the court system here today?
We spoke with Annie Carpinetti before. In fact, this draft has her fingerprints all over it. And the reason why it's indeterminate is because until the law goes into place, the Department of Law does not know if what kind of impact this will have. In other words, how many people will take advantage of their right to hearing. I can tell you, and Annie will correct me immediately if I'm wrong, but neither one of us expect there's going to be a rush of hearing requests. That advocacy from law enforcement to property owners, whether we're arguing with the DA or the court or for the we are trying to get property back. Sometimes it fails, and we just can't seem to get an agreement. There can be a number of reasons. Maybe another party doesn't want the property to go back because they're hoping that'll help force a settlement, frankly. If everybody just agrees to drop the matter, then we'll release our right to have the property held as evidence. So.
Okay. Other questions? All right. Thank you. We have Victor. Let's go to public testimony right now. We have Victor Kester online. Mr. Kester, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Dyson, Mr. Kopp. My name is Victor Kester. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights, and today I'd like to take this opportunity to respectfully testify before the committee in support of Senate Bill number 30. I believe that this is an appropriate mechanism for property owners to seek return of their property through requesting a hearing before the court. At the hearing, the parties, the interested parties in the criminal action, the Department of Law, law enforcement, and others, can determine what is in the best interest of justice with respect to the crime victim's return of the property in question. Often property crime victims may have to wait months, if not years, for return of their property. And again, Senate Bill 30 allows a mechanism for the return of the property that was taken from the crime victim by allowing him or her to request a hearing before a judge and work with others to determine the best interests of justice with regard to the return of said property. The OVR, the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights, believes in the principles of restorative justice, and we echo the sentiments of Senator Dyson's testimony. I believe Senate Bill 30 appropriately balances the interests of the parties involved in a criminal action, both the crime victim and other interested parties, which would include the Department of Law and their interest in prosecuting a case, since the victim is allowed to request a hearing, and at that hearing, the interests of all the various parties can be discussed. Senate Bill 30 principally provides a mechanism where a crime victim can seek return of their property. With that, I stand open to any questions before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Kester. Other questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Kester. Appreciate your advocacy on behalf of Alaska's victims. Anyone else online wanting to testify? Okay, seeing none. Anyone else in the room wanting to testify? Okay, do we have anyone here? Well, I guess I would be interested to hear from, at some point, either getting late in the day, but I would be interested in hearing from someone from the troopers and someone from the court system, whether it's Annie Carpinetti. Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Ms. Carpinetti will testify when this bill goes before judiciary. And as you mentioned earlier, she had us in conflict this morning.
Thank you. All right. Do you want to come forward?
Hello. For the record, my name is Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with the State Troopers. The department's officially neutral on this bill. It's the standard practice of the department that we return property just as quickly as possible. We really don't see that this would change that too much. There are some cases where ownership of property could be contested, and a court hearing would actually be a preferred thing. So it's not necessarily bad or good in our opinion. I can say that for a number of years I've supervised evidence facilities all over Southeast Alaska. I cannot think of a single case where somebody has needed property back immediately that we were not able to make that happen. If I were to receive a call from a member of the public saying I need something back, my next call is generally to the Department of Law, specifically the District Attorney's Office, requesting that, you know, if we can get that property back immediately. And we try to find other means to make that happen, photograph the property, or do some type of activity to get that back as quickly as possible. So with that, I'm open to answer any questions if you have any questions regarding this.
How often, well, let me ask you this question. How many cases involve the department taking possession of evidence? Do you have a sense across the state?
Mr. Chairman, I would say most cases that result in charges actually being filed against an individual in some manner will have some evidence actually seized in one way or another.
Are we talking thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands?
Mr. Chairman, the department generally has over 100,000 actual calls per year. Of those, a fraction of those are actual cases that will be referred for criminal prosecution. So if I were to wager a guess, I would say maybe 10,000 cases a year where property statewide is actually seized and put into our evidence facilities. In those cases, the managers of those facilities, it is in our vested interest to move that property as quickly as possible. So we're always on top of that. And the moment that we get a disposition form back from the district attorney's office, that property, it's our goal to get that property out the door if it can be returned to the owners. In some cases, it's forfeited to the state. In some cases, it's destroyed because it's contraband. But I mean, that's been our goal ever since I can remember. And the 6 years that I've supervised the facilities in Southeast Alaska, I simply cannot remember a single case where I wasn't able to get critical equipment or something that's extremely important to an owner back in a very quick amount of time if we needed to do that.
And I guess one concern I have with this bill is, I mean, I certainly support the concept. My biggest concern is if you have 10,000 pieces of evidence that are, or 10,000 cases where evidence is seized per year, and if even 10% of those people are now, and you're saying there's no problems with the way we're doing business now, and then you're, under this bill, we're requiring that you go to court. Anyone can just call you up and say, hey, I want to go to court. I want my evidence back, and then you're required to file documents with the court. I guess I just want to hear more, flesh this out a little more about, are we creating the potential for thousands of time cases that you have to now file to go to court? Do you foresee that, or do you?
Mr. Chairman, I've spent some time, even last session, actually talking to our district attorney's office about this, and honestly, I really didn't see it as that big of a deal. As a manager currently, if somebody had a request for their property back, that request in Southeast Alaska would probably go through me. And I would simply call up the district attorney's office and say, you know, we would like to give this evidence back. Is it critical to the case? And if so, can you give me something that I can relay to the victim on why we should keep this? And generally, that kind of solves the problem as far as the troopers are concerned. If this law were to pass, I would simply call up the district attorney's office, and they would have to make that determination. Are we going to request a court hearing, or are we going to give the evidence back? And if they're going to request a court hearing, I wouldn't perceive that being very many cases in a given year statewide for the troopers.
Can you talk a little bit about what's sort of the typical type of evidence that you seize? If you have 10,000 cases where you're taking in evidence, what's sort of the typical?
The vast majority is just evidence that we physically seize, and that would be recordings, photographs, those type of things. In a number of cases, for example, property crimes, we're actually going to be seizing stolen property that we recover. And we do occasionally statewide, we'll get the request, somebody, you know, will have recovered somebody's jewelry or some other valuable, and they'll want it back. In most of those cases, though, if we talk to the individual and say, you know, it would be preferred if we can retain that item for trial, most folks would rather do whatever they can to help see that prosecution be successful versus getting the property back immediately. In the cases where in the past they've asked for the property back immediately, sometimes we do have options. We can photograph it and use those photographs at trial and then in the interim give the property back. Sometimes it's a case-by-case basis that we actually have to coordinate with the district attorney's office. Fortunately, it really doesn't happen that often.
Are there cases that you're aware of where people aren't getting their property back and forced to file a civil suit?
Mr. Chairman, in 20 years, I've never seen that personally.
Have you talked to people in other jurisdictions outside of Southeast about this issue, and is this a problem in other jurisdictions that you're aware of?
Mr. Chairman, as a trooper and a manager, I've been stationed in every geographical location in the state, and I've not seen that with the troopers. I do not know about some of the municipalities, though. I can just say that based on my experience as a manager and a supervisor and a trooper, it has always been our policy that we're to return property just as quickly as possible, keep our evidence rooms as clean as possible and as orderly as possible. The longer we retain an item, in many cases, the harder it becomes to return it because people move and those type of things. As far as the municipalities and the other police departments, I'm just not aware of that.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Giesel.
Trooper Dial, I appreciate your talking with us. Could you define as soon as possible? Can you quantify that? What are we talking about, returning as soon as possible? In an hour, in a week, in a year?
Through the chair, if we can return it immediately, we'll return it immediately. There are cases where we can, for low-level property crimes, photograph it right on the scene. We're comfortable enough with a relationship with the district attorney's office to know that they will not have an issue with us photographing and returning that property. In more complex cases and felony cases, generally as soon as possible can be a matter of days after we consult with the district attorney's office and find out if they desire that property retained as evidence for trial. Hopefully that helps clarify that.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, we're getting to 10:30. Is there anyone else in the room wanting to testify? Okay, seeing none, Trooper Dial, thank you again for your testimony. We're going to leave the public testimony open. I would like to hear from Ms. Carpinetti before we move the bill and maybe bear down a little bit on the procedures in place right now and impact across the state. So we're going to hold the public testimony open on this bill, and with that, we're adjourned.